Chapter 4, Joe's Hunch. Later that afternoon, Joe and Catherine were back in Joy's lab, engaging her in further discussion over a simple meal. "I have a hunch," said Joe, putting aside the remnants of the snack. "If you two are finished eating, let's take your data, Joy, and go to the main navigational tank. We'll need lots of space for this." A few minutes later, the three of them were in the enormous navigational hall of the space station. In the center of the hall was a 3D tank that was over 30 feet square and 20 feet deep. Joe approached the officer in charge. "Major Rockford, may we appropriate the tank for a few minutes?" "Go ahead, Joe." Joe, Catherine, and Joy walked up to the rail that surrounded the tank and looked into it. Spread out below them was a stunning array of lights that depicted the portion of the galaxy local to Larson's Folly. In the center of the display was a very bright light orange ball about an inch in diameter that represented Marcanto. Tiny blue lights showed the positions of its six planets, all of them small and close into their sun. The outermost planet, Larson's Folly, glowed brightly to distinguish it from its five companions. Throughout the rest of the tank, white lights represented the local star systems. "Joy," said Joe, "feed your data into the system here and show us those rings. Reduce the scale in the tank so we can see where those rings are actually located in the galaxy." "I'm already at work, Joe. This is exciting. Okay, here." The scale in the tank became smaller and smaller until nearly a quarter of the Milky Way galaxy showed. The bright core of the galaxy was just below their feet. Joe could see Omega Centauri, where the Xenobots' home planet had been, but his gaze didn't linger there. He focused on the rings of colored lights that spread out from a point in the center of the tank. Beyond that point was a map of the Scutum Centaurus arm and the space just before it and beyond. Larson's Folly was located about 50,000 light-years from Earth's sun, almost precisely on the 330-degree galactic longitude. The arm stretched away from the viewers to the left, and there was a great space with very few stars in front of it and another space behind it. A light banding of stars like sparkling dust showed where the galaxy ended. "Now, add a ring. Show us where the ring would have been if the planet had been refueled according to schedule." Joy nodded, worked her controls for a moment, and then an orange ring appeared within the tank. "Orange okay, to distinguish it from the other lines?" "Yeah, sure, of course. Now, presumably that ring shows where the energy source would have been 500 or 600 years ago." "Naturally, and before you ask," a few seconds later, another ring appeared, bright green. "Here you go. Right at this very minute, the source of the energy is somewhere within this ring." "Ah," Joe breathed out a sigh of satisfaction and leaned back in his chair. "Now the question is, what is it?" "Right. Obviously, the source of energy is moving, and we can track its history for the past 5 millennia. Because of that, we can quickly figure out that it's not connected with a solar system or a star. Its trajectory proves that. Even a comet is part of a solar system, so it can't be a comet unless it's a very unusual one." Joe said, "Whatever this object is, it's traveling on its own. It may be something artificial that is constructed. As you've pointed out, Larson's Folly is a formed planet. Something intelligent and purposeful made it what it is, and had a stake in keeping it that way for a long time. But why did they select something that was moving in such an unusual way?" For several minutes he stared silently into the tank, then said, "Well, let's go back to the exogeophysics lab." They'd only left the navigational hall for about a minute before Joe suddenly stopped short. He stared into space for a few seconds as Catherine and Joy watched him silently, observing him think. Then, "Let's go back," he said quietly. "Reload those images, Joy." Minutes later, the three of them were staring into the tank at the rings Joy had brought up for the second time. "This should have been obvious," Joe muttered to himself. He lifted his chin to point toward the rings. Those rings show where the source of energy has traveled over the past 50,000 years or so, he said aloud. We can't tell exactly what it was on the rings, but that's not important right now. The rings get bigger and bigger with time and farther away from Larson's Folly. Suppose, Joe said musingly, we just guess where the earlier rings could have been. You see, those rings out there look to me like the big end of a horn of plenty, if you follow me. Where's the rest of the horn? Joy's eyes opened wide. Yes, she said. She frantically began to work the controls. I can do this more thoroughly when we get back to my lab, she said. But a rough, really rough guess can do for now. Several minutes went by. Once Joy impatiently shook her head and grimaced, paused her manipulations, and then plunged back into them. Then she looked up into the tank. Ah, she said. A broad grin split Joe's face. I'm not surprised, he said. A shape like a horn of plenty had appeared in the tank. Working backward from the bright green ring that showed where the elusive source of Larson's Folly energy lay right at the moment, there was a bent cone whose apex lay not far from the bright orange ball that represented Marcanto. How long ago was the source in this system, Joy? Very roughly half a million years ago, very roughly. The three of them scraped their chairs into close configuration and bent their heads together as Joe started to speak. Joy, remind us how we found Larson's Folly. It was about a year or so after Luxa was destroyed, wasn't it? Right. 8 years ago last month, said Joy. It was discovered during the quick scouring of the galaxy when we were looking for any unusual phenomena that might indicate the presence of any previously unknown Xenobot bases. We had to make sure we'd gotten them all. Obviously, we couldn't be very thorough, but a quick look was better than nothing. Small probes did most of the work. Larson's Folly had extraordinary gravitational anomalies, so once our probes were in this sector of the galaxy, the planet stood out like a football player in a harem. After the probes reported what they'd found, a manned ship came right out here. That would have been in late 2161. The report was so strange that we had to see for ourselves, which was just how the scouring was supposed to function. Luigi Marcanto was the captain of the ship. When his ship arrived in the system, it was obvious that they could never land on the planet. They couldn't see much of anything below the clouds by any means. So a fellow Texan named Rafa Larson volunteered to take a shuttlecraft down. Brave, but nuts. He slipped below the top of the clouds just in time to get caught in three windstorms, one after the other, before he was able to break free and come back to the ship. I've heard the audio record of his howls, which is one of the funniest sound bites you'll ever hear. Funny, at least, once they knew he was safe. So the captain named the planet for him. Anyway, the ship quickly discovered a long-abandoned Xenobot base in stationary orbit hovering right above the biggest anomaly on the planet. We took the place over and turned it into this space station for observation and research. It took about 4 years. Zane was made fully operational 3 years ago, but as I said before, I've been here since the work of making this place habitable began. The first crew arrived on January 16th, 2162. It was my 28th birthday, so I'll never forget the date. Okay, more than 7 years ago, Joe furrowed his brow. I thought it was longer than that. Well, all that information supports my hunch. Here it is. We know that the Xenobots drew on the energy of stars for just about all their power. We also know that over the recent millennia, the quality of their sentience was declining at a rapid rate. They'd lost their ability to understand their technology that at one time had been formidable. The janitor told us that the Xenobots were really the victors in the War of the First Races. The Xenobots, or Lucians as they were then, won because they were masters of space-time. But as they forgot their technology, they lost their ability to maintain it. Though still formidable, they were a dying, weakening race when we fought them. Now, isn't it probable that the space-time stasis on Larson's Folly are prison houses for the first races? Doesn't it make sense that the energy to maintain the space-time stasis is drawn from this new heavy element you found, stuff made from stars? Isn't it likely that the Lucians use that material to seed the core of the planet to turn up the heat inside? Doesn't it fit right into what we now know, that whatever has been powering the energy core of Larson's Folly is deteriorating and hasn't been maintained for 2,000 years? Joe's two listeners had sat unmoving as he'd been talking. They hadn't even blinked. He paused for dramatic effect and then concluded, punctuating his words by gesturing with his finger in the air, "Isn't it likely that what we're looking for is the Lucians' primary weapon in their war against the First Races? A weapon that has been untended for who knows how long, and probably won't be too far away from this tormented planet below us." Joe leaned back in his chair. "For some reason I can't even guess, that little item has been traveling away from the Mercanto system for untold eons, but it used to be native to it. If we can find that weapon, that energy source, it may be possible to free the First Races. If we can't, or if we can't defuse the weapon if we do find it, then as Joy said a few moments ago, the sudden collapse of the singularities on Larson's Folly will precipitate a catastrophe of unimaginable proportions." Catherine said quietly, "Joe, I'm sure you're right. I think we're on the edge of either a very frightening disaster or the greatest deliverance the galaxy has ever seen." Over the next 2 days, by urgent encrypted real-time transmission, Joe shared his hypothesis with Richard Starlight in Edmondson City. "Joe, your logic is sound," said Richard, "but whether your Lucian connection is the truth or not is really less important than finding this energy source, whatever it is. That's a lot of space to search, but we'll start combing that ring without delay." "Kathy," began Rachel, "I'm receiving an urgent message from Richard Starlight. He wants you to receive it in real time. Shall I display it?" Starman Kathy Foster's heart began to beat faster. A message from Richard Starlight himself, and urgent? She'd left Emmanuel less than 24 hours earlier. What could be so urgent so soon? "Of course, Rachel, thank you." "It's my pleasure," said Rachel, and the face of Richard Starlight appeared on the screen in the lounge of the Raptor where Kathy was relaxing. The starman sat up straight. "Hello, Kathy," Richard began before the starman could speak. "How's your journey so far?" After some small talk, Richard presented Kathy with the gist of Joe's reasoning about the situation on Larson's Folly. "And so I'd like you to make the search for the energy source the goal of your mission. There will be others searching through that portion of the galaxy, but you're one of the few available starmen we've got, and having a particular mission should make the experimental work with your holocom even more useful and reliable." "Very well, Richard, I'd like that." "You'll need to take the Raptor to the Gronberg refueling station connected with Elijah Base on Titan. You'll need some specialized equipment for your search that the Raptor doesn't have. I'll see to it that the station knows you're coming so that whoever's there can get started assembling what you'll need. I'll also ask Joe Taylor to contact you so he can give you the details of the new discoveries on Larson's Folly. Let me ask Rachel to contact Joe for me, Richard. It'll be a good test of the system." Richard nodded. "Right." After a few pleasantries, the real-time connection was terminated. Kathy felt a surge of energy that focused her attention on her new task. An assignment, her first outer space assignment as a starman. Already her apprehension about being solo for so long was a little diminished. She smiled and said, "Rachel, please contact Starman Joseph Taylor for me," as she made her way to the Raptor's data lab.